had some practice and learned the language, I'm confident I could. But to speak the plain truth, that sort of energy of expression has its inconveniences, and a man is liable to interruption. Well, you see that yourself. Vigorous writing is calculated to elevate the public, no doubt, but then I do not like to attract so much attention as it calls forth. I can't write with comfort when I'm interrupted so much as I've been today. I like this berth well enough, but I don't like to be left here to wait on the customers. The experiences are novel, I grant you, and entertaining, too, after a fashion. But they're not judiciously distributed. A gentleman shoots at you through the window and cripples me. A bombshell comes down the stovepipe for your gratification and sends the stove door down my throat. A friend drops in to swap compliments with you and freckles me with bullet holes till my skin won't hold my principles. You go to dinner and Jones comes with his cowhide. Gillespie throws me out of the window. Thompson tears all my clothes off, and an entire stranger takes my scalp with the easy freedom of an old acquaintance. And in less than 5 minutes, all the blackguards in the country arrive in their war paint and proceed to scare the rest of me to death with their tomahawks. Take it all together, I never have had such a spirited time in all my life as I have had today. No, I like you. And I like your calm, unruffled way of explaining things to the customers. But you see, I am not used to it. The Southern heart is too impulsive. Southern hospitality is too lavish with the stranger. The paragraphs which I have written today, and into whose cold sentences your masterly hand has infused the fervent spirit of Tennessean journalism, will wake up another nest of hornets. All that mob of editors will come, and they will come hungry, too, and want somebody for breakfast. I shall have to bid you adieu. I decline to be present at these festivities. I came south for my health. I will go back on the same errand, and suddenly. Tennessee journalism is too stirring for me. After which we parted with mutual regret. And I took apartments at the hospital. 1869. The Story of the Good Little Boy Who Did Not Prosper. The following has been written at the instance of several literary friends who thought that if the history of the bad little boy who did not come to grief, a moral sketch which I published 5 or 6 years ago, was worthy of preservation several weeks in print, a fair and unprejudiced companion piece to it would deserve a similar immortality. Editor Memoranda. Once there was a good little boy by the name of Jacob Blivens. He always obeyed his parents, no matter how absurd and unreasonable their demands were, and he always learned his book, and never was late at Sabbath school. He would not play hooky, even when his sober judgment told him it was the most profitable thing he could do. None of the other boys could ever make that boy out. He acted so strangely. He wouldn't lie, no matter how convenient it was. He just said it was wrong to lie, and that was sufficient for him. And he was so honest that he was simply ridiculous. The curious ways that Jacob had surpassed everything. He wouldn't play marbles on Sunday. He wouldn't rob birds' nests. He wouldn't give hot pennies to organ grinders' monkeys. He didn't seem to take any interest in any kind of rational amusement. So the other boys used to try to reason it out and come to an understanding of him, but they couldn't arrive at any satisfactory conclusion. As I said before, they could only figure out a sort of vague idea that he was afflicted. And so they took him under their protection, and never allowed any harm to come to him. This good little boy read all the Sunday school books. They were his greatest delight. This was the whole secret of it. He believed in the good little boys they put in the Sunday school books. He had every confidence in them. He longed to come across one of them alive once, but he never did. They all died before his time, maybe. Whenever he read about a particularly good one, he turned over quickly to the end to see what became of him, because he wanted to travel thousands of miles and gaze on him. But it wasn't any use. That good little boy always died in the last chapter. And there was a picture of the funeral, with all his relations and the Sunday school children standing around the grave, in pantaloons that were too short, and bonnets that were too large, and everybody crying into handkerchiefs that had as much as a yard and a half of stuff in them. He was always headed off in this way. He never could see one of those good little boys, on account of his always dying in the last chapter. Jacob had a noble ambition to be put in a Sunday school book. He wanted to be put in with pictures representing him gloriously declining to lie to his mother, and she weeping for joy about it, and pictures representing him standing on the doorstep giving a penny to a poor beggar woman with six children, and telling her to spend it freely, but not to be extravagant, because extravagance is a sin. And pictures of him magnanimously refusing to tell on the bad boy, who always lay in wait for him around the corner as he came from school, and welted him over the head with a lath, and then chased him home, saying, "Hi, hi," as he proceeded. That was the ambition of young Jacob Blivens. He wished to be put in a Sunday school book. It made him feel a little uncomfortable sometimes when he reflected that the good little boys always died. He loved to live, you know, and this was the most unpleasant feature about being a Sunday school book boy. He knew it was not healthy to be good. He knew it was more fatal than consumption to be so supernaturally good as the boys in the books were. He knew that none of them had ever been able to stand it long, and it pained him to think that if they put him in a book, he wouldn't ever see it. Or even if they did get the book out before he died, it wouldn't be popular without any picture of his funeral in the back part of it. It couldn't be much of a Sunday school book that couldn't tell about the advice he gave to the community when he was dying. So at last, of course, he had to make up his mind to do the best he could under the circumstances, to live right, and hang on as long as he could, and have his dying speech all ready when his time came. But somehow nothing ever went right with this good little boy. Nothing ever turned out with him the way it turned out with the good little boys in the books. They always had a good time, and the bad boys had the broken legs. But in his case there was a screw loose somewhere, and it all happened just the other way. When he found Jim Blake stealing apples, and went under the tree to read to him about the bad little boy who fell out of a neighbor's apple tree and broke his arm, Jim fell out of the tree too, but he fell on him and broke his arm, and Jim wasn't hurt at all. Jacob couldn't understand that. There wasn't anything in the books like it. And once, when some bad boys pushed a blind man over in the mud, and Jacob ran to help him up and receive his blessing, the blind man did not give him any blessing at all, but whacked him over the head with his stick and said he would like to catch him shoving him again and then pretending to help him up. This was not in accordance with any of the books. Jacob looked them all over to see. One thing that Jacob wanted to do was to find a lame dog that hadn't any place to stay, and was hungry and persecuted, and bring him home and pet him and have that dog's imperishable gratitude. And at last he found one, and was happy, and he brought him home and fed him. But when he was going to pet him, the dog flew at him and tore all the clothes off him, except those that were in front, and made a spectacle of him that was astonishing. He examined authorities, but he could not understand the matter. It was of the same breed of dogs that was in the books, but it acted very differently. Whatever this boy did, he got into trouble. The very things the boys in the books got rewarded for turned out to be about the most unprofitable things he could invest in. Once, when he was on his way to Sunday school, he saw some bad boys starting off pleasuring in a sailboat. He was filled with consternation, because he knew from his reading that boys who went sailing on Sunday invariably got drowned. So he ran out on a raft to warn them, but a log turned with him and slid him into the river. A man got him out pretty soon, and the doctor pumped the water out of him and gave him a fresh start with his bellows, but he caught cold and lay sick abed 9 weeks. But the most unaccountable thing about it was that the bad boys in the boat had a good time all day, and then reached home alive and well in the most surprising manner. Jacob Bliven said there was nothing like these things in the books. He was perfectly dumbfounded. When he got well, he was a little discouraged, but he resolved to keep on trying anyhow. He knew that so far his experiences wouldn't do to go in a book, but he hadn't yet reached the allotted term of life for good little boys, and he hoped to be able to make a record yet, if he could hold on till his time was fully up. If everything else failed, he had his dying speech to fall back on. He examined his authorities and found that it was now time for him to go to sea as a cabin boy. He called on a ship captain and made his application, and when the captain asked for his recommendations, he proudly drew out a tract and pointed to the words, "To Jacob Blivens, from his affectionate teacher." But the captain was a coarse, vulgar man, and he said, "Oh, that be blowed. That wasn't any proof that he knew how to wash dishes or handle a slush bucket," and he guessed he didn't want him. This was altogether the most extraordinary thing that ever had happened to Jacob in all his life. A compliment from a teacher, on a tract, had never failed to move the tenderest of emotions of ship captains, and open the way to all offices of honor and profit in their gift. It never had in any book that ever he had read. He could hardly believe his senses. This boy always had a hard time of it. Nothing ever came out according to the authorities with him. At last, one day when he was around hunting up bad little boys to admonish, he found a lot of them in the old iron foundry, fixing up a little joke on 14 or 15 dogs, which they had tied together in long procession, and were going to ornament with empty nitroglycerin cans, made fast to their tails. Jacob's heart was touched. He sat down on one of those cans, for he never minded grease when duty was before him, and he took hold of the foremost dog by the collar, and turned his reproving eye upon wicked Tom Jones. But just at that moment, Alderman McWelter, full of wrath, stepped in. All the bad boys ran away, but Jacob Blivens rose in conscious innocence and began one of those stately little Sunday school book speeches, which always commence with, "Oh, sir," in dead opposition to the fact that no boy, good or bad, ever starts a remark with, "Oh, sir." But the alderman never waited to hear the rest. He took Jacob Blivens by the ear and turned him around and hit him a whack in the rear with the flat of his hand, and in an instant that good little boy shot out through the roof and soared away toward the sun, with the fragments of those 15 dogs stringing after him like the tail of a kite. And there wasn't a sign of that alderman or that old iron foundry left on the face of the earth. And as for young Jacob Blivens, he never got a chance to make his last dying speech, after all his trouble fixing it up, unless he made it to the birds, because although the bulk of him came down all right in a treetop in an adjoining county, the rest of him was apportioned around among 4 townships, and so they had to hold 5 inquests on him to find out whether he was dead or not, and how it occurred. You never saw a boy scattered so. Note, this catastrophe is borrowed, without the unknown but most ingenious owner's permission, from a stray newspaper item, and trimmed up and altered to fit Jacob Blivens, who stood sadly in need of a doom that would send him out of the world with éclat. Editor Memoranda. Thus perished the good little boy, who did the best he could, but didn't come out according to the books. Every boy who ever did as he did prospered, except him. His case is truly remarkable. It will probably never be accounted for. 1870. How I edited an agricultural paper once. I did not take the temporary editorship of an agricultural paper without misgivings. Neither would a landsman take command of a ship without misgivings. But I was in circumstances that made the salary an object. The regular editor of the paper was going off for a holiday, and I accepted the terms he offered and took his place. The sensation of being at work again was luxurious, and I wrought all the week with unflagging pleasure. We went to press, and I waited a day with some solicitude to see whether my effort was going to attract any notice. As I left the office toward sundown, a group of men and boys at the foot of the stairs dispersed with one impulse and gave me passageway, and I heard one or two of them say, "That's him." I was naturally pleased by this incident. The next morning I found a similar group at the foot of the stairs, and scattering couples and individuals, standing here and there in the street and over the way, watching me with interest. The group separated and fell back as I approached, and I heard a man say, "Look at his eye." I pretended not to observe the notice I was attracting, but secretly I was pleased with it, and was purposing to write an account of it to my aunt. I went up the short flight of stairs and heard cheery voices and a ringing laugh as I drew near the door, which I opened, and caught a glimpse of two young rural-looking men, whose faces blanched and lengthened when they saw me, and then they both plunged through the window with a great crash. I was surprised. In about half an hour an old gentleman with a flowing beard and a fine but rather austere face entered, and sat down at my invitation. He seemed to have something on his mind. He took off his hat and set it on the floor, and got out of it a red silk handkerchief and a copy of our paper. He put the paper on his lap, and while he polished his spectacles with his handkerchief, he said, "Are you the new editor?" I said I was. "Have you ever edited an agricultural paper before?" "No," I said, "this is my first attempt."
"Very likely. Have you had any experience in agriculture, practically?"
"No, I believe I have not."
"Some instinct told me so," said the old gentleman, putting on his spectacles and looking over them at me with asperity, while he folded his paper into a convenient shape. "I wish to read you what must have made me have that instinct. It was this editorial. Listen and see if it was you that wrote it. Turnips should never be pulled. It injures them. It is much better to send a boy up and let him shake the tree. Now, what do you think of that? For I really suppose you wrote it."
"Think of it? Why, I think it is good. I think it is sense. I have no doubt that every year millions and millions of bushels of turnips are spoiled in this township alone by being pulled in a half-ripe condition, when, if they had sent a boy up to shake the tree—"
"Shake your grandmother! Turnips don't grow on trees."
"Oh, they don't they? Well, who said they did? The language was intended to be figurative, wholly figurative. Anybody that knows anything will know that I meant that the boy should shake the vine." Then this old person got up and tore his paper all into small shreds and stamped on them, and broke several things with his cane, and said I did not know as much as a cow, and then went out, and banged the door after him, and, in short,
acted in such a way that I fancied he was displeased about something. But, not knowing what the trouble was, I could not be any help to him. Pretty soon after this, a long, cadaverous creature, with lanky locks hanging down to his shoulders, and a week's stubble bristling from the hills and valleys of his face, darted within the door, and halted, motionless, with finger on lip, and head and body bent in listening attitude. No sound was heard. Still he listened. No sound. Then he turned the key in the door, and came elaborately tiptoeing toward me, till he was within long-reaching distance of me, when he stopped, and, after scanning my face with intense interest for a while, drew a folded copy of our paper from his bosom, and said,
"There, you wrote that. Read it to me, quick. Relieve me. I suffer."
I read as follows, and as the sentences fell from my lips, I could see the relief come. I could see the drawn muscles relax and the anxiety go out of the face, and rest and peace steal over the features, like the merciful moonlight over a desolate landscape. The guano is a fine bird, but great care is necessary in rearing it. It should not be imported earlier than June, nor later than September. In the winter it should be kept in a warm place, where it can hatch out its young. It is evident that we are to have a backward season for grain. Therefore it will be well for the farmer to begin setting out his corn stalks and planting his buckwheat cakes in July instead of August. Concerning the pumpkin, this berry is a favorite with the natives of the interior of New England, who prefer it to the gooseberry for the making of fruit cake, and who likewise give it the preference over the raspberry for feeding cows, as being more filling and fully as satisfying. The pumpkin is the only esculent of the orange family that will thrive in the north, except the gourd and one or two varieties of the squash. But the custom of planting it in the front yard with the shrubbery is fast going out of vogue, for it is now generally conceded that the pumpkin, as a shade tree, is a failure. Now, as the warm weather approaches and the ganders begin to spawn, the excited listener sprang toward me to shake hands, and said,
"There, there, that will do. I know I am all right now, because you have read it just as I did, word for word. But, stranger, when I first read it this morning, I said to myself, I never, never believed it before. Notwithstanding my friends kept me under watch so strict, but now I believe I am crazy." And with that I fetched a howl that you might have heard 2 miles, and started out to kill somebody. Because, you know, I knew it would come to that sooner or later, and so I might as well begin. I read one of them paragraphs over again, so as to be certain, and then I burned my house down and started. I have crippled several people, and have got one fellow up a tree, where I can get him if I want him. But I thought I would call in here as I passed along and make the thing perfectly certain. And now it is certain, and I tell you it is lucky for the chap that is in the tree. I should have killed him sure as I went back. Good-bye, sir, good-bye. You have taken a great load off my mind. My reason has stood the strain of one of your agricultural articles, and I know that nothing can ever unseat it now. Good-bye, sir."
I felt a little uncomfortable about the cripplings and arsons this person had been entertaining himself with, for I could not help feeling remotely accessory to them. But these thoughts were quickly banished, for the regular editor walked in. I thought to myself, now if you had gone to Egypt, as I recommended you to, I might have had a chance to get my hand in, but you wouldn't do it, and here you are. I sort of expected you. The editor was looking sad, and perplexed, and dejected. He surveyed the wreck which that old rioter and these 2 young farmers had made, and then said, This is a sad business, a very sad business. There is the mucilage bottle broken, and 6 panes of glass, and a spittoon, and 2 candlesticks. But that is not the worst. The reputation of the paper is injured, and permanently, I fear. True, there never was such a call for the paper before, and it never sold such a large edition or soared to such celebrity. But does one want to be famous for lunacy, and prosper upon the infirmities of his mind? My friend, as I am an honest man, the street out here is full of people, and others are roosting on the fences, waiting to get a glimpse of you, because they think you are crazy. And well they might, after reading your editorials. They are a disgrace to journalism. Why, what put it into your head that you could edit a paper of this nature? You do not seem to know the first rudiments of agriculture. You speak of a furrow and a harrow as being the same thing. You talk of the molting season for cows, and you recommend the domestication of the polecat on account of its playfulness and its excellence as a ratter. Your remark that clams will lie quiet if music be played to them was superfluous, entirely superfluous. Nothing disturbs clams. Clams always lie quiet. Clams care nothing whatever about music. Ah, heavens and earth, friend, if you had made the acquiring of ignorance the study of your life, you could not have graduated with higher honor than you could today. I never saw anything like it. Your observation that the horse chestnut as an article of commerce is steadily gaining in favor is simply calculated to destroy this journal. I want you to throw up your situation and go. I want no more holiday. I could not enjoy it if I had it. Certainly not with you in my chair. I would always stand in dread of what you might be going to recommend next. It makes me lose all patience every time I think of your discussing oyster beds under the head of landscape gardening. I want you to go. Nothing on earth could persuade me to take another holiday. Oh, why didn't you tell me you didn't know anything about agriculture? Tell you, you cornstalk, you cabbage, you son of a cauliflower. It's the first time I ever heard such an unfeeling remark. I tell you, I've been in the editorial business going on 14 years, and it is the first time I ever heard of a man's having to know anything in order to edit a newspaper. You turnip! Who write the dramatic critiques for the second-rate papers? Why, a parcel of promoted shoemakers and apprentice apothecaries, who know just as much about good acting as I do about good farming, and no more. Who review the books? People who never wrote one. Who do up the heavy leaders on finance? Parties who have the largest opportunities for knowing nothing about it. Who criticize the Indian campaigns? Gentlemen who do not know a war whoop from a wigwam, and who never have had to run a foot race with a tomahawk, or pluck arrows out of the several members of their families to build the evening campfire with. Who write the temperance appeals and clamor about the flowing bowl? Folks who will never draw another sober breath till they do it in the grave. Who edit the agricultural papers, you yam? Men as a general thing who fail in the poetry line, yellow-covered novel line, sensation drama line, city editor line, and finally fall back on agriculture as a temporary reprieve from the poorhouse. You try to tell me anything about the newspaper business. Sir, I have been through it from Alpha to Omaha, and I tell you that the less a man knows, the bigger noise he makes and the higher the salary he commands. Heaven knows, if I had but been ignorant instead of cultivated, and impudent instead of diffident, I could have made a name for myself in this cold, selfish world. I take my leave, sir. Since I have been treated as you have treated me, I am perfectly willing to go. But I have done my duty. I have fulfilled my contract as far as I was permitted to do it. I said I could make your paper of interest to all classes, and I have. I said I could run your circulation up to 20,000 copies, and if I'd had 2 more weeks, I'd have done it. And I'd have given you the best class of readers that ever an agricultural paper had, not a farmer in it, nor a solitary individual who could tell a watermelon from a peach vine to save his life. You are the loser by this rupture, not me, pie plant. Adios.
I then left. 1870. Political economy. Political economy is the basis of all good government. The wisest men of all ages have brought to bear upon this subject the... Here I was interrupted, and informed that a stranger wished to see me down at the door. I went and confronted him and asked to know his business, struggling all the time to keep a tight rein on my seething political economy ideas, and not let them break away from me, or get tangled in their harness. And privately I wished the stranger was in the bottom of the canal, with a cargo of wheat on top of him. I was all in a fever, but he was cool. He said he was sorry to disturb me, but as he was passing, he noticed that I needed some lightning rods. I said, yes, yes, go on, what about it? He said there was nothing about it in particular, nothing except he would like to put them up for me. I am new to housekeeping, have been used to hotels and boarding houses all my life. Like anybody else of similar experience, I try to appear to strangers to be an old housekeeper. Consequently, I said, in an offhand way, that I had been intending for some time to have 6 or 8 lightning rods put up, but, the stranger started and looked inquiringly at me, but I was serene. I thought that if I chanced to make any mistakes, he would not catch me by my countenance. He said he would rather have my custom than any man's in town. I said, all right, and started off to wrestle with my great subject again, when he called me back and said it would be necessary to know exactly how many points I wanted put up, what parts of the house I wanted them on, and what quality of rod I preferred. It was close quarters for a man not used to the exigencies of housekeeping, but I went through creditably, and he probably never suspected that I was a novice. I told him to put up 8 points, and put them all on the roof, and use the best quality of rod. He said he could furnish the plain article at 20 cents a foot, coppered 25 cents, zinc-plated spiral twist at 30 cents, that would stop a streak of lightning any time, no matter where it was bound, and render its errand harmless, and its further progress apocryphal. I said apocryphal was no slouch of a word, emanating from the source it did. But philology aside, I liked the spiral twist, and would take that brand. Then he said he could make 250 feet answer, but to do it right and make the best job in town of it, and attract the admiration of the just and the unjust alike, and compel all parties to say they never saw a more symmetrical and hypothetical display of lightning rods since they were born, he supposed he really couldn't get along without 400, though he was not vindictive and trusted he was willing to try. I said, go ahead and use 400 and make any kind of a job he pleased out of it, but let me get back to my work. So I got rid of him at last, and now, after half an hour spent in getting my train of political economy thoughts coupled together again, I am ready to go on once more. Richest treasures of their genius, their experience of life and their learning, the great lights of commercial jurisprudence, international confraternity, and biological deviation, of all ages, all civilizations, and all nationalities, from Zoroaster down to Horace Greeley, have... Here I was interrupted again, and required to go down and confer further with that lightning-rod man. I hurried off, boiling and surging with prodigious thoughts, wombed in words of such majesty that each one of them was in itself a straggling procession of syllables that might be 15 minutes passing a given point. And once more I confronted him, he so calm and sweet, I so hot and frenzied. He was standing in the contemplative attitude of the Colossus of Rhodes, with one foot on my infant tuberose and the other among my pansies. his hands on his hips, his hat brim tilted forward, one eye shut and the other gazing critically and admiringly in the direction of my principal chimney. He said now there was a state of things to make a man glad to be alive, and added, I leave it to you if you ever saw anything more deliriously picturesque than 8 lightning rods on 1 chimney. I said I had no present recollection of anything that transcended it. He said that in his opinion nothing on this earth but Niagara Falls was superior to it in the way of natural scenery. All that was needed now, he verily believed, to make my house a perfect balm to the eye, was to kind of touch up the other chimneys a little, and thus add to the generous coup de l'oeil a soothing uniformity of achievement which would allay the excitement naturally consequent upon the first coup d'etat. I asked him if he learned to talk out of a book, and if I could borrow it anywhere. He smiled pleasantly and said that his manner of speaking was not taught in books, and that nothing but familiarity with lightning could enable a man to handle his conversational style with impunity. He then figured up an estimate, and said that about 8 more rods, scattered about my roof, would about fix me right, and he guessed 500 feet of stuff would do it, and added that the first 8 had got a little the start of him, so to speak, and used up a mere trifle of material more than he had calculated on, 100 feet or along there. I said I was in a dreadful hurry, and I wished we could get this business permanently mapped out so that I could go on with my work. He said I could have put up those 8 rods and marched off about my business. Some men would have done it, but no, I said to myself, this man is a stranger to me, and I will die before I'll wrong him. There ain't lightning rods enough on that house, and for one I'll never stir out of my tracks till I've done as I would be done by, and told him so. Stranger, my duty is accomplished. If the recalcitrant and dephlogistic messenger of heaven strikes your— There now, there, I said. Put on the other 8. Add 500 feet of spiral twist. Do anything and everything you want to do, but calm your sufferings, and try to keep your feelings where you can reach them with the dictionary. Meanwhile, if we understand each other now, I will go to work again. I think I've been sitting here a full hour this time, trying to get back to where I was when my train of thought was broken up by the last interruption. But I believe I have accomplished it at last, and may venture to proceed again. Wrestled with this great subject, and the greatest among them have found it a worthy adversary, and one that always comes up fresh and smiling after every throw. The great Confucius said that he would rather be a profound political economist than chief of police. Cicero frequently said that political economy was the grandest consummation that the human mind was capable of consuming. And even our own Greeley has said vaguely but forcibly that— Here the lightning rod man sent up another call for me. I went down in a state of mind bordering on impatience. He said he would rather have died than interrupt me, but when he was employed to do a job, and that job was expected to be done in a clean, workmanlike manner, and when it was finished and fatigue urged him to seek the rest and recreation he stood so much in need of, and he was about to do it, but looked up and saw at a glance that all the calculations had been a little out, and if a thunderstorm were to come up, and that house, which he felt a personal interest in, stood there with nothing on earth to protect it but 16 lightning rods, "Let us have peace!" I shrieked. "Put up 150! Put some on the kitchen! Put a dozen on the barn! Put a couple on the cow! Put one on the cook! Scatter them all over the persecuted place till it looks like a zinc-plated, spiral-twisted, silver-mounted canebrake. Move! Use up all the material you can get your hands on. And when you run out of lightning rods, put up ramrods, cam rods, stair rods, piston rods, anything that will pander to your dismal appetite for artificial scenery,
and bring respite to my raging brain, and healing to my lacerated soul.
Wholly unmoved, further than to smile sweetly, this iron being simply turned back his wristbands daintily, and said he would now proceed to hump himself. Well, all that was nearly 3 hours ago. It is questionable whether I am calm enough yet to write on the noble theme of political economy, but I cannot resist the desire to try, for it is the one subject that is nearest to my heart and dearest to my brain of all this world's philosophy. Quote, "Political economy is heaven's best boon to man," close quote. When the loose but gifted Byron lay in his Venetian exile, he observed that if it could be granted him to go back and live his misspent life over again, he would give his lucid and unintoxicated intervals to the composition not of frivolous rhymes, but of essays upon political economy. Washington loved this exquisite science. Such names as Baker, Beckwith, Judson, Smith are imperishably linked with it. And even Imperial Homer, in the 9th book of the Iliad, has said, "Fiat justitia ruat silum, post mortem unum antebellum, hic jacet hoc, ex parte res, politicum economico est." The grandeur of these conceptions of the old poet, together with the felicity of the wording which clothes them, and the sublimity of the imagery whereby they are illustrated, have singled out that stanza and made it more celebrated than any that ever... Now, not a word out of you, not a single word. Just state your bill and relapse into impenetrable silence forever and ever on these premises. $900, is that all? This check for the amount will be honored at any respectable bank in America. What is that multitude of people gathered in the street for? How? Looking at the lightning rods? Bless my life, did they never see any lightning rods before? Never saw such a stack of them on one establishment, did I understand you to say? I will step down and critically observe this popular ebullition of ignorance. 3 days later. We are all about worn out. For 24 hours our bristling premises were the talk and wonder of the town. The theaters languished, for their happiest scenic inventions were tame and commonplace compared with my lightning rods. Our street was blocked night and day with spectators, and among them were many who came from the country to see. It was a blessed relief on the second day when a thunderstorm came up and the lightning began to go for my house, as the historian Josephus quaintly phrases it. It cleared the galleries, so to speak. In 5 minutes there was not a spectator within half a mile of my place, but all the high houses about that distance away were full, windows, roof, and all. And well they might be, for all the falling stars and 4th of July fireworks of a generation put together and rained down simultaneously out of heaven in one brilliant shower upon one helpless roof would not have any advantage of the pyrotechnic display that was making my house so magnificently conspicuous in the general gloom of the storm. By actual count, the lightning struck at my establishment 764 times in 40 minutes, but tripped on one of those faithful rods every time, and slid down the spiral twist and shot into the earth before it probably had time to be surprised at the way the thing was done. And through all that bombardment, only one patch of slates was ripped up, and that was because for a single instant the rods in the vicinity were transporting all the lightning they could possibly accommodate. Well, nothing was ever seen like it since the world began. For one whole day and night, Not a member of my family stuck his head out of the window, but he got the hair snatched off it as smooth as a billiard ball. And if the reader will believe me, not one of us ever dreamt of stirring abroad. But at last the awful siege came to an end, because there was absolutely no more electricity left in the clouds above us, within grappling distance of my insatiable rods. Then I sallied forth, and gathered daring workmen together, and not a bite or a nap did we take till the premises were utterly stripped of all their terrific armament, except just 3 rods on the house, 1 on the kitchen, and 1 on the barn. And behold, these remain there even unto this day. And then, and not till then, the people ventured to use our street again. I will remark here in passing that during that fearful time I did not continue my essay upon political economy. I am not even yet settled enough in nerve and brain to resume it. To whom it may concern, parties having need of 3,211 feet of best quality, zinc-plated, spiral-twist lightning-rod stuff, and 1,631 silver-tipped points, all in tolerable repair, and, although much worn by use, still equal to any ordinary emergency, can hear of a bargain by addressing the publishers of this magazine. 1870. A true story, repeated word for word as I heard it. It was summertime and twilight. We were sitting on the porch of the farmhouse on the summit of the hill, and Aunt Rachel was sitting respectfully below our level on the steps, for she was our servant and colored. She was of mighty frame and stature. She was 60 years old, but her eye was undimmed and her strength unabated. She was a cheerful, hearty soul, and it was no more trouble for her to laugh than it is for a bird to sing. She was under fire now, as usual, when the day was done. That is to say, she was being chaffed without mercy, and was enjoying it. She would let off peal after peal of laughter, and then sit with her face in her hands and shake with throes of enjoyment, which she could no longer get breath enough to express. At such a moment as this, a thought occurred to me, and I said, "Aunt Rachel, how is it that you've lived 60 years and never had any trouble?" She stopped quaking. She paused, and there was a moment of silence. She turned her face over her shoulder toward me and said, without even a smile in her voice, "Mr. C., is you an honest?" It surprised me a good deal, and it sobered my manner and my speech, too. I said, "Why, I thought, well, that is, I meant, why, you can't have had any trouble. I've never heard you sigh, and never seen your eye when there wasn't a laugh in it." She faced fairly around now and was full of earnestness. "Has I had any trouble? Mr. C., I's gwine to tell you, then I leave it to you. I was born down amongst the slaves. I knows all about slavery, 'cause I've been one of 'em my own self. Well, sir, my old man, that's my husband, he was lovin' and kind to me, just as kind as you is to your own wife. And we had chillen, 7 chillen, and we loved them chillen just the same as you loves your chillen. They was black, but the Lord can't make no chillen so black but what their mother loves 'em and wouldn't give 'em up. No, not for anything that's in this whole world. Well, sir, I was raised in old Virginny, but my mother, she was raised in Maryland. And my soul, she was terrible when she'd get started. My land, but she'd make the fur fly. When she'd get into them tantrums, she always had one word that she said.
She'd straighten herself up and put her fists in her hips and say, "I want you to understand that I want Barn and Dimash to be fooled by trash. I's one of the old blue hen's chickens, I is." Case you see, dat's what folks that's born in Maryland calls theyselves, and they's proud of it. Well, that was her word. I don't ever forget it, because she said it so much, and because she said it one day when my little Henry tore his wrists awful and most busted his head right up at the top of his forehead, and the niggers didn't fly around fast enough to tend to him. And when they talk back at her, she up and she says, "Looky here," she says, "I want you niggers to understand that I want Barn and Dimash to be fooled by trash. I's one of the old blue hen's chickens, I is." And then she clear that kitchen and bandage up the child herself. So I says that word too when I's riled. Well, by and by my old mistress says she's broke and she got to sell all the niggers on the place. And when I hear that they're going to sell us all off at auction in Richmond, oh, the good gracious, I know what that mean. Aunt Rachel had gradually risen while she warmed to her subject, and now she towered above us, black against the stars. "They put chains on us and put us on a stand as high as this porch, 20 foot high, and all the people stood round, crowds and crowds. And they'd come up there and look at us all round and squeeze our arm and make us get up and walk. And then say, 'This one too old, or this one lame, or this one don't mount to much.' And they sold my old man and took him away. And they begin to sell my chillen and take them away. And I begin to cry. And the man say, 'Shut up, your damn blubberin',' and hit me on the mouth with his hand. And when the last one was gone but my little Henry, I grab him close up to my breast, so, and I riz up and says, 'You shan't take him away,' I says. 'I'll kill the man that touches him,' I says. But my little Henry whisper and say, 'I gwine to run away, and then I work and buy your freedom.' Oh, bless the child, he always so good. But they got him. They got him. The men did. But I took and tear the clothes most off of them and beat them over the head with my chain, and they give it to me, too, but I didn't mind that. Well, there was my old man gone, and all my chillen, all my 7 chillen, and 6 of them I hain't set eyes on again to this day, and that's 22 year ago last Easter. The man that bought me belong in Newburn, and he took me there. Well, by and by the years roll on, and the war come. My master, he was a Confederate colonel, and I was his family's cook. So when the Unions took that town, they all run away and left me all by myself, with the other niggers in that monstrous big house. So the big Union officers move in there, and they ask me would I cook for them. 'Lord bless you,' says I, 'that's what I's for.' And they weren't no small fry officers, mind you. They was the biggest they is, and the way they made them soldiers mosey round. The general, he told me to boss that kitchen, and he say, 'If anybody come meddling with you, you just make 'em walk chalk. Don't you be afeard,' he say. 'You's among friends now.' Well, I thinks to myself, if my little Henry ever got a chance to run away, he'd make to the north, of course. So one day I comes in there where the big officers was, in the parlor, and I drops a curtsy, so, and I up and told 'em about my Henry. They're listening to my troubles just the same as if I was white folks. And I says, 'What I come for is because if he got away and got up north where you gemmen comes from, you might have seen him, maybe, and could tell me so's I could find him again. He was very little, and he had a scar on his left wrist and at the top of his forehead.' And then they look mournful, and the general say, 'How long since you lost him?' And I say, 13 year. And then the general say, "'He wouldn't be little no more now. He's a man.' "'I never thought of that before. "'He was only that little fella to me yet. "'I never thought about him growing up and being big. "'But I see it then. "'None of the gentlemen had run across him, "'so they couldn't do nothing for me. "'But all that time, though I didn't know it, "'my Henry was run off to the north. "'Years and years.' And he was a barber, too, and worked for hisself. And by and by, when the war come, he ups and he says, "'I's done barberin',' he says. "'I's gwine to find my old mammy, lessen she's dead.' So he sold out and went to where they was recruitin', and hired hisself out to the colonel for his servant. And then he went all through the battles everywhere, huntin' for his old mammy. Yes, indeedy, he'd hired a first one officer and then another, till he'd ransacked the whole South. But you see, I didn't know nothing about this. How was I going to know it? Well, one night we had a big soldier ball. The soldiers, Dart Newburn, was always having balls and carrying on. They had 'em in my kitchen, heaps of times, 'cause it was so big. Mind you, I was down on sich doings, because my place was with the officers, and it rasped me to have them common soldiers cavortin' round my kitchen like that. But I always stood around and kept things straight, I did. And sometimes they'd get my dander up, and then I'd make 'em clear that kitchen, mind I tell you. Well, one night, it was a Friday night, there comes a whole platoon from a nigger regiment that was on guard at the house. The house was headquarters, you know. And then I was just a bilin'. Mad? I was just a boomin'. I swelled around and swelled around. I just was a itchin' for 'em to do something for to start me. And they was a waltzin' and a dancin'. My, but they was havin' a time. And I had just a swelling and a swelling up. And pretty soon along comes sich a spruce young nigger, a sailing down the room with a yaller wench round the waist, and round and round and round they went, enough to make a body drunk to look at 'em. And when they got abreast of me, they went to kind of balancing around, first on one leg and then on the other, and smiling at my big red turban, and making fun. And I ups and says, "Get along with you, rubbage!" And the young man's face kind of changed all of a sudden for about a second. But then he went to smiling again, same as he was before. Well, about this time in come some niggers that played music and belonged to the band, and they never could get along without putting on airs. And the very first air they put on that night, I lit into 'em. They laughed, and that made me worse. The rest of the niggers got to laughing, and then my soul alive, but I was hot. My eye was just a-blazin'. I just straightened myself up so, just as I is now, plumb to the ceiling most, and I digs my fists into my hips, and I says, "Looky here," I says, "I want you niggers to understand that I want bone in the mash to be fooled by trash. I's one of the old blue hen's chickens, I is." And then I see that young man stand a-staring and stiff, looking kind of up at the ceiling like he forgot something and couldn't remember it no more. Well, I just march on them niggers, so, looking like a general, and they just cave away before me and out at the door. And as this young man was a-going out, I hear him say to another nigger, "Jim," he says, "you go along and tell the captain I be on hand about 8 o'clock in the morning. There's something on my mind," he says. "I don't sleep no more this night. You go along," he says, "and leave me by my own self." This was about 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, about 7 I was up and on hand getting the officer's breakfast. I was a-stooping down by the stove, just so, same as if your foot was the stove, and I'd opened the stove door with my right hand, so, pushing it back, just as I pushes your foot, and I'd just got the pan of hot biscuits in my hand and was about to raise up, when I see a black face come around under mine,
and her eyes are looking up into mine, just as eyes are looking up close under your face now. And I just stopped right there, and never budged, just gazed and gazed so. And the pan began to tremble, and all of a sudden I knowed. The pan drop on the floor, and I grab his left hand and shove back his sleeve, just so, as I's doing to you, and then I goes for his forehead and push the hair back, so, and, boy, I says, if you ain't my Henry, what is you doing with this welt on your wrist and that scar on your forehead? The Lord God of heaven be praised, I got my own again. Oh, no, Mr. C., I ain't had no trouble, and no joy.
1874. The Facts Concerning the Recent Carnival of Crime in Connecticut. I was feeling blithe, almost jocund. I put a match to my cigar, and just then the morning's mail was handed in. The first superscription I glanced at was in a handwriting that sent a thrill of pleasure through and through me. It was Aunt Mary's, and she was the person I loved and honored most in all the world, outside of my own household. She had been my boyhood's idol. Maturity, which is fatal to so many enchantments, had not been able to dislodge her from her pedestal. Nope, it had only justified her right to be there, and placed her dethronement permanently among the impossibilities. To show how strong her influence over me was, I will observe that long after everybody else's "do stop smoking" had ceased to affect me in the slightest degree, Aunt Mary could still stir my torpid conscience into faint signs of life when she touched upon the matter. But all things have their limit in this world. A happy day came at last, when even Aunt Mary's words could no longer move me. I was not merely glad to see that day arrive. I was more than glad. I was grateful. For when its sun had set, the one alloy that was able to mar my enjoyment of my aunt's society was gone. The remainder of her stay with us that winter was in every way a delight. Of course, she pleaded with me just as earnestly as ever after that blessed day to quit my pernicious habit, but to no purpose whatever. The moment she opened the subject, I at once became calmly, peacefully, contentedly indifferent, absolutely adamantinely indifferent. Consequently, the closing weeks of that memorable visit melted away as pleasantly as a dream. They were so freighted for me with tranquil satisfaction. I could not have enjoyed my pet vice more if my gentle tormentor had been a smoker herself, and an advocate of the practice. Well, the sight of her handwriting reminded me that I was getting very hungry to see her again. I easily guessed what I should find in her letter. I opened it. Good. Just as I expected. She was coming. Coming this very day, too, and by the morning train. I might expect her any moment. I said to myself, I am thoroughly happy and content now. If my most pitiless enemy could appear before me at this moment, I would freely right any wrong I may have done him. Straightway the door opened, and a shriveled, shabby dwarf entered. He was not more than 2 feet high. He seemed to be about 40 years old. Every feature and every inch of him was a trifle out of shape, and so, while one could not put his finger upon any particular part and say, "This is a conspicuous deformity," the spectator perceived that this little person was a deformity as a whole, a vague, general, evenly blended, nicely adjusted deformity. There was a fox-like cunning in the face and the sharp little eyes, and also alertness and malice. And yet this vile bit of human rubbish seemed to bear a sort of remote and ill-defined resemblance to me. It was dully perceptible in the mean form, the countenance, and even the clothes, gestures, manner, and attitudes of the creature. He was a far-fetched, dim suggestion of a burlesque upon me, a caricature of me in little. One thing about him struck me forcibly and most unpleasantly. He was covered all over with a fuzzy greenish mold, such as one sometimes sees upon mildewed bread. The sight of it was nauseating. He stepped along with a chipper air, and flung himself into a doll's chair, in a very free and easy way, without waiting to be asked. He tossed his hat into the wastebasket. He picked up my old chalk pipe from the floor, gave the stem a wipe or two on his knee, filled the bowl from the tobacco box at his side, and said to me in a tone of pert command,
"Give me a match."
I blushed to the roots of my hair, partly with indignation, but mainly because it somehow seemed to me that this whole performance was very like an exaggeration of conduct which I myself had sometimes been guilty of in my intercourse with familiar friends. But never, never with strangers, I observed to myself. I wanted to kick the pygmy into the fire, but some incomprehensible sense of being legally and legitimately under his authority forced me to obey his order. He applied the match to the pipe, took a contemplative whiff or two, and remarked, in an irritatingly familiar way,
"Seems to me it's devilish odd weather for this time of year."
I flushed again, and in anger and humiliation as before, for the language was hardly an exaggeration of some that I have uttered in my day, and moreover was delivered in a tone of voice and with an exasperating drawl that had the seeming of a deliberate travesty of my style. Now there is nothing I am quite so sensitive about as a mocking imitation of my drawling infirmity of speech. I spoke up sharply and said, "Look here, you miserable..."